founders of the Henry Gruber's Books NT, and they are both long-term practitioners in the Tayu Order, which is rooted in the teachings of Gurdjieff. And tonight, the topic is objective prayer, prayer of service.
Thank you. So I asked Stuart before we began, when we were coming over here, if he had, as a child, ever memorized any prayers, as I had to do, because I was brought up Catholic. And he said he hadn't, except for grace at meals. And since we're not sharing food tonight, I thought I'd start us off with the very first prayer that my mother taught me, probably about the age of five, just as a type example for us to examine what prayer is, what prayer is not, and what we mean by our exploration of prayer today. So it's very simple, very straightforward. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. So, explain.
That's a good one. I'm not sure I can explain that. I have all these fourth way ideas coming up about that presupposes that the soul exists in the individual.
There's a good one there. Okay, so that's one
right.
Question.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about that prayer is that what comes up for me about that is it has a quality about that all, many ordinary prayers share, which is that it recapitulates a relationship to forces larger than ourselves. The recapitulation is that we're something small, there are these large forces out there, we're sort of in danger and vulnerable, and we need help for those, and we beseech that larger force to be kind to us so that everything will be okay. And that kind of prayer is a variation of form, but many, many of the kind of traditional religious forms of prayer that we're taught, we hear about, have that kind of style. Sometimes they devolve into what's called a petitioner's prayer, where there's something you want, and you ask this higher power that you're disconnected with to provide it, because in some senses you're powerless yourself to provide it. And so always in these kinds of ordinary prayers, there's this notion that one is separate from the ultimate, one is subject to forces outside of one's control, and one needs wants help to make everything all okay. And that's a different kind of prayer than the kind of prayer we're ultimately going to talk about. But before we go into that, I'm just interested if, you know, what other people's relationship to prayer is, and if your experiences have been more along the lines of the petitioner prayer or the small meek person looking for help, or if there might be something else that prayer means for you.
Well, maybe it just means words in a book.
Lately I've been praying at every meal and just giving thanks for what's before me, and and acknowledging that the life force that's coming to me from this food is something that I should honor, and in a way that by living my life, even with a more love and joy in a more courageous manner. So I don't know where that falls into prayer, but it's, as I was raised Catholic too, where they're kind of teaching you that, you're God is up here and you're down there, and you're speaking up here, ask either pleading for him not to smite you, or asking for favors, you know, to do something good. So I just want to take a different approach as I could to that. Just say, give thanks for whatever. Use prayer as a way of giving thanks, acknowledging the good things that are happening instead of petitioning for anything.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, that's certainly a different modality of prayer, and that's, in one sense, prayer as appreciation, or prayer as acknowledgement. And that's interesting, because that's a different, that has a different flavor or different energy than the petitioner prayer, because it's not so much there an issue of separation, but more of an immediate, I'd say, an emotional response to the universe, which is just expressing appreciation or recognizing appreciation and perhaps connectedness. Certainly some forms of food prayer and food meditations have one consider and reflect upon the connectedness and the causes and conditions that have gone through to put this food onto your plate and have it there.
Something that's so essential to our life force and being that we can't do without every day. And how often do we really recognize the importance of what that is? Yes, before we consume it, it's a blessing to recognize it.
Right. Yeah, and so that has a very different energy, a different quality of energy, and a different experience than the petitioner prayer, or the prayer out of fear, or the prayer where we say, if we get out of this tough situation, that we'll go to church every day, you know, Sunday for the rest of our lives.
Which isn't a bad thing necessarily. That is to say, I don't think we mean to set up, or at least I certainly don't mean to set up a dichotomy: good prayer, bad prayer, petitioner prayer, bad prayer, something else that we'll talk about, good prayer. When I was probably not long after I was taught the prayer I just recited by my mother, I spontaneously decided to ask God for a typewriter. I was probably 5 or 6 years old. I didn't even know how to read yet. But somehow I had the idea that I was supposed to be a writer. And I knew that writers had to have typewriters. So I asked God. And over a period of time, actually, you know, I sort of periodically renewed my supplication for a typewriter. And what happened was, can be viewed within a shorter and a longer time frame. The shorter time frame was that I didn't get a typewriter. And I got mad at God, or disappointed and annoyed at God for not doing what I wanted. I mean, I was doing, you know, I was filling in the spaces and the form, as it were, submitting the form and not getting a response. And that seemed to suck. So I was, you know, not happy about that. But if you look at it from a longer perspective, I actually did get a typewriter. In fact, I got several typewriters as the years went by, and now I have word processors and things that make it much easier to write than I could ever have imagined, that anyone could have imagined at the time when I was asking for a typewriter originally. So in fact, God responded to my prayer, you could say, in a perfectly appropriate way. That is, gave me what I needed to what I wanted and I needed, but in the time frame that I could actually make use of it. That is to say, for me to ask for a typewriter when I didn't even know how to read was kind of silly. But I was a child. I was 5 years old, so you know, it wasn't like I was had mature judgment at that point. But my point is that I don't think it was wrong or bad for me to do that, and moreover, I'm grateful now that that things worked out the way they did. But there was this period where I was quite ticked off at the Almighty for not giving me instant gratification as I had thought, or nearly instant gratification as I thought I deserved, of course. So I think part of what we're starting off with is a sort of a discrimination of different ways to approach prayer. And it's not that any of them are inherently bad or wrong, but we also want to, it's our intention to to suggest some other ways to do that. And the gratitude that you mentioned is, I think, a very useful attitude to cultivate, and very helpful.
As you were describing that, I was wondering if now you pray for time to write.
Well, I haven't, but I could.
I wish I had time.
Right. Lord, give me an hour.
Right. Which is one of the interesting things about petitioning prayer, in that when we frame a prayer in a particular way, we're effectively taking a position within ourselves, or maintaining a position, or taking a posture, and the petitioning prayer tends to reinforce a posture of wanting or not having, and the answer to that prayer typically is a realization of that posture, which is wanting and not having. And so we think of prayer as this sort of asking, and asking the big force for something to get something, in sort of the ordinary way of thinking about it. But if we think of prayer as a posture that we're holding, then in a sense the posture that we assume in the prayer is the answer to the prayer.
Well, ideally, I would think that you want to get yourself to that place where your whole life is a walk of meditation and prayer, that you're constantly in that flow, that you're not mm-hmm. a separation, and you're not petitioning only in desperation, but mm-hmm. it's just a constant part of who you are, a constant interaction between you, your higher self, and whatever you choose to call the divine force that permeates us.
Well, I think that's nicely stated. It sort of advances the discussion a little bit, because it suggests that there's a different kind of interpretation of prayer that isn't trying to get something,
which
but
is what I'm, yes, exactly.
But is more prayer as a state of being.
Then you will find that what you need will be coming to you because you are in that state.
Right.
Although what you need may be different than what you expect,
and so
that's another part of this
right.
equation.
Yeah, or what you get is what you need, and that if one there might be a posture that one can assume, and we can call that prayer, where everything that arises for one in one's life is exactly what one needs. And one greets it in that way, with the sense of gratitude and the sense of openness that you were describing in the prayer for food. And if one can do that all the time, that seems like that would be a different way of living than most of us are able to achieve on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely.
But I think it's more real than, petitioning a God that may or may not exist only when you need help, and then promising to go to church if you get what you need.
Right.
I mean, that concept, I think, is doing us more harm spiritually than it's helping anyone.
Right.
Well, okay. You said, I think it's more real, but if only that were true. That is to say that the point I want to make, while agreeing with your formulation quite precisely, I also want to point out that most of us, it isn't just a matter of wishing to live our lives as a prayer to the divine. It's a matter of how we enact that in our lives from moment to moment. How do we do that? And in fact, that's in large part what we want to talk about tonight. So, there's a book we have here in the store called The Lost Christianity by Jacob Needleman. And in that book, Needleman makes the point that the Christian admonition of Christ to love your neighbor as yourself is actually an extremely advanced practice that can only be done by people who are engaged in a very profound, meditative practices, but prayerful and uh, rightly conceived and rightly enacted program. Or, in other words, it's not something that we wish, that we can wish ourselves into. We actually have to have concrete steps that we can take in our lives to do this. And so, very important to bring up. And so, you know, when you tell someone you should love your neighbor as yourself, and they try to do that, what they find, what we all find, in the course of ordinary life, is we get very mad at people very easily, without even wishing to do so. And we find it virtually impossible to love some people, despite our best wishes and despite our earnest attempts to persuade ourselves that we should love them and must love them, but in all honesty, finding that that's not working. So it's not that it's impossible to do, but it is the product of a definite set of steps that that require a real commitment. And you know, the great saints of any tradition have enacted that, but that's why they're saints. They're special because they have enacted that, because they've gone to that, taken those extra steps in order to be able to love others as themselves, and, or whatever admonition that, you know, you want to choose. So thank you. That's a very good, helpful observation.
So I wanted to build on what you were saying, because the idea of this, there is this place we can be or we can inhabit that is somehow in tune with the operation of the universe, the operation of all that is a very interesting one and powerful one, because it suggests then that there might be a sort of an operational nature to what prayer, or what we'll call objective prayer, is about. So rather than, you know, prayer being a petitioning sort of thing, or prayer being based off of, you know, trying to, you know, do good or be safe, if prayer is about aligning ourselves to the universe, aligning ourselves to all and everything, or the, you know, the creative force in the universe, then prayer might then be more of a operational meditation when done properly, that can be done in a very specific way, that's not not about reinforcing a sense of separation, but more about engendering a sense of alignment. And that becomes that makes prayer a more specialized operation, or at least what we'll call objective prayer, because what you're describing of that idea is along the lines of what we mean by objective prayer. Objective prayer is intended to cultivate in ourselves objective reason, as it's referred to in the Fourth Way tradition, which is the clarity and the alignment, the in-tuneness with the universe, such that we can fulfill our ultimate purpose for being here, which is to serve the ends of the ultimate, to serve the absolute, to be of service. In a sense, when everything else, you know, falls away, all our needs fall away, and we're completely in tune with the universe, all that's really left, all that really matters, is to be of service. And that is the meaning of our lives. And prayer, objective prayer, is a way for us to align ourselves with that place. But in order for us to align ourselves in that place, very much along the lines of what Rob is describing, we first have to recognize and acknowledge through the process of prayer what place we're starting from. And once we can see what place we're starting from, then the operation of prayer can affect, at certain points, an aligning. And an aligning and a transformation such that we reorient our attention from the kind of self-centered and object-oriented kind of attention that we normally reserve for daily life, to to a kind of attention that brings us to a sense of connectedness with the universe, but also a sense of readiness and a sense of openness. And if we can effect that transition, then we are praying in the objective sense. All of the other kinds of prayers that we've talked about earlier, at least the particularly the petitioning kinds of prayers, are more of a, you know, kind of a psychological activity, which is not objective prayer in the sense that we're referring to. You know, we can call it many different things, but objective prayer is about methodically bringing ourselves into alignment with the ultimate nature, such that we become and become connected to all that's happening and all that is. And from that place, then, we can affect our destiny, which is to be of service.
So how do we start doing this process that Stuart's referring to? I'll suggest for your consideration that we need to start where we are. In other words, we can't ascend higher on the ladder than the lowest rung of the bottom foot, whichever one that is. We need to assess precisely where we are, which means what our habits are, our mechanical and reactive habits of mind, heart, and body, and really see those things. That is part of prayer. That is something we need to listen to. You know, sometimes it's not perhaps the normal thing to think of prayer as something where we're listening to ourselves or listening to our lives. But precisely that's where we need to start, because we have to start at the beginning. We have to see what we're actually doing moment by moment. So that's where we begin. And we can use prayers as more customarily conceived, that is, prayers written down or prayers memorized, as we spoke about before, to focus attention. But that's not the central act of prayer. The central part of prayer is putting attention on the universe. And what we want to do is create a tool of attention in our consciousness, to recreate our consciousness as a tool of attention that is extremely effective at putting attention on God or on all and everything. And we start at home. We start where we should be most familiar, but where most of us are actually quite unfamiliar. That is, our own habits. We think we're familiar with ourselves, but actually we have habits that redirect our attention away from what we're doing all the time. So we have to change those habits in order to be present to what's happening in our lives moment by moment. To get back to your point, we have to be present to all that stuff. So that's where we start. That can be a meditative technique. In our tradition, we do something called self-observation. It's a particular meditative technique that by which we observe, without comment, without judgment, without evaluation, the contents of our lives, moment by moment, day by day. And that's the foundation, then, of this form of objective prayer that Stuart's talking about.
So, any questions at this point before we continue on?
Does this make sense? Are we going someplace you aren't following? Yeah.
Maybe you're going to get there, but when you said that we're in service or being in service to what is, that, I guess that sort of, to me, means that there is some higher goal or something that's wanting something. And is that sort of
Well,
I mean, what if it's just sort of like a universe that doesn't really have a, you know, a desire?
Doesn't give a damn?
Yeah.
Well, I in one sense, I would say that it's possible to be in service to even a universe that doesn't give a damn. And, you know, you could argue ultimately if the universe expands and collapses back over and over again over many Kali Yugas or whatever the great expansion is, that in some ultimate sense there's no damn to give because it all gets recycled and gets recreated again. But a good analogy to what I was describing in terms of realizing our relationship to the ultimate is analogous to the practical examples we have at hand, which is like a cell in our body is both an individual, part of a local group, and part of a larger organism. And the cell, when it's functioning properly and completely in alignment and is healthy, is participating in a greater unity than it may in its individual consciousness be aware of, but it's still being of service, as opposed to like cancerous cells that start to sort of be at war with the surrounding body. And so even if we don't cognize a higher purpose in a sense that we would understand in our conscious mind, that doesn't preclude the possibility of actually being of service as being part of a living universe. And, you know, to me, you know, different people can take different positions on this, but just even from a mental point of view, there's, you know, we are organisms that have minds and purposes, however limited they are. We may well be part of an organism that's larger than us that has purposes that we're not aware of, and those purposes may be as aimless at this point as our small purposes, or they may be in the process of evolving or waking up to larger purposes. We don't know. But it is possible in this to explore for oneself whether there is a qualitative difference in our experience or our sense of being when we attempt to align ourselves with this larger force. Because ultimately, I can't answer the question for you. Ultimately, I can't prove one way or the other whether there's something larger or whether the universe gives a damn. Well, you have to prove that for yourself. And in that sense, you might look at objective prayer in the sense that we're describing as the laboratory for you to explore that question. You can't really explore that question without being willing to align oneself to a larger being if such a being exists.
But you don't have to start out with a predetermined answer.
Right. And so, in one sense, you know, certainly our tradition is grounded in a healthy skepticism. And anything that we say here, we offer more as hypotheses for you to prove for yourself. So I'm not going to claim conclusively that there is ultimate meaning to being of service. I offer that as a hypothesis. And it's your job, if you're serious about the question, and if the question is meaningful for you, to test that hypothesis. And we can offer certain ways of testing it, and you can verify for yourself whether those ways actually lead to an objective change of being for yourself. So does that dodge the question effectively?
Maybe you'll get to it later.
Well, I mean, I know.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard
I'm also interested in how you develop the meditation.
Okay. I mean, you know, ultimately, that's the challenge of that kind of question, which is I can say all sorts of things, and I might say it eloquently, I might be very charming, and you might, you know, emotionally get some sort of buy-in about because of the words I'm using, and I might have lots of charisma about that, but that's not verifying, you know, that's more like hypnosis, you know. What we're trying to offer here is a way of praying and a path of praying that allows you to test for yourself the truth, these questions of ultimate truth. Because ultimately it doesn't mean anything unless we can verify it in our own experience.
Right. I'm willing to claim that it feels better to live a life of service than not. But, as Stuart says, each of us has to verify that, the truth of that statement, for yourself. If it's an interesting question for you, if it's an important question for you, no one else can do it. Assertions, I don't buy assertions. There's, you know, dime a dozen. I generate them all the time. But the only thing that really matters is what you can verify in your own self-examination.
So you're saying the service is the prayer, the service you provide for whatever it is, for the higher self community is
ultimately
the prayer itself.
Ultimately, but that's getting pretty far along the path. What I'm also saying though is that the process itself of learning how to first pay attention to your life, that is itself service. I'll assert for your consideration, not as something I'm willing to defend, but for your consideration, the idea that paying attention to your life is as good a reason to be alive, as good a form of service to God as anything I've ever read or heard about. That is, being God's eyes to that to which you alone are particularly privileged, your own existence in this body. That being conscious of that, that bringing full awareness to that, is your gift of service to offer to God or to the divine, as well as to yourself. So it's both, and it's all the steps leading up to it. But when you get to service in a big capital S, the sort of thing that a great Indian saint, for example, I'm thinking of a guy named Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar, who would only, you know, he claimed pretty much to be just about only doing whatever his father, as he cognized it, his father told him to do, from moment to moment, you know, Krishna or whatever, Rama. And that led him to live the life of a beggar, to live a life without compromise in a certain kind of way. So that's an extraordinary form of service. In the West, I don't know that being a beggar in the streets is necessarily the way we need to think about going. The forms of service vary. You know, potential forms of service vary. So, the kind of path that we're talking about doing, that is, starting by paying attention to your life without changing your life and having to change any outward detail of your life, what you do, even what you think or feel, without having to change any of that, but simply observing it in a rigorous and consistent way on an ongoing basis, that itself can lead to the most profound prayer, the most profound service. That's essentially our argument here, our suggestion for you guys to consider. And it doesn't have to be our path by any means. That's one of the funnier things that's arisen in human culture now. And now that all these spiritual paths are coming together, you know, we get to hear all these people saying, well, I'm better than you. My way is better than your way. No. People are different. People need different ways. Some people will benefit by doing the self-observation path that we do. Other people will, you know, like this guy Ram Sarat Kumar that I just mentioned, will learn to internalize a song of prayer to to the form of divinity to which you might be attracted, such that eventually that becomes the warp and weft of your mind and heart, and everything gets understood in the context of that activity, that ongoing activity. There's different ways. So there's different ways, different paths to do this basic thing. But when Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar is dancing around singing to Ram, singing praises of Ram, he's paying attention. Or he was. He's dead now. He was paying attention to life in a particular kind of way, with a particular kind of intensity that most of us don't achieve on a consistent basis, because we haven't created the tools to do that on a consistent basis. That's what it takes, is the creation of internal tools to do that.
So you're saying the service of objective prayer is conscious awareness?
Yes.
Of what you do,
yes.
In the moment.
Yes.
The moment.
Essentially.
As opposed to going out and providing a
yes.
gentle service
yes.
to the community.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. In the sense that we're describing the activation of attention in this way, the turning of attention and the intensifying of attention in this way is service to the absolute, and that. We don't have to worry about how that affects the details in our lives. Mm-hmm. In a sense, you know, we turn on in this way, and then we let God deal with the details. We allow the details of our lives to unfold, and it may be that we continue doing what we're doing. We may decide to radically change our life path and do something different. We may serve the community in obvious ways, or we may serve it in very subtle ways.
Yeah, before we, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But the service is the being awake to our lives, and we can get into, if we have time, you know, deeper aspects of that. But you know, what does it mean to be in alignment? Well, being in alignment means that now functions within ourselves begin to have an active force over what we do, like our conscience, and this becomes a guide for what right action is. We don't have to figure it out, because when we're aligned in this way, when we're praying in this way, right action emerges from us as naturally as we take a breath. And then again, the details take care of themselves. We don't have to preconceive what those details are, and that's being of service. It's changing the energy in the world around us. It's waking up the divine. And as Rob was describing with Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar, certain paths, certainly the devotional paths from the East that have one constantly seeing everything as a manifestation of God, is one particular practice to bring oneself into that kind of alignment. You know, the Kuan Yin chanting that we'll be doing here next week is a way of bringing oneself into that kind of alignment. And we'll talk in a moment about within the Talyu tradition what kinds of forms we use to bring ourselves into alignment. But that's what the process of prayer is about, and that's what the service is. It's not some idea of doing right or doing good, and that all may be fine, and it's certainly the case that someone who is serving in this way is likely not to do certain kinds of things. But the service is at a different level than we're used to thinking. It's adding energy. It's adding a kind of a quality of energy to life that isn't in large supply, and has a transforming effect, a freeing effect, an opening effect on everyone who is touched by that energy.
So 3.5, a little more than that, years ago, we opened this bookstore because it seemed like a good idea at the time. It seemed like, and when we started down the path, the universe created conditions that made it possible to open the store in an extraordinarily short period of time. In other words, obstacles that might have arisen disappeared. things that had to happen in a certain sequence in order to open within this time frame that we had set up. They just click, 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 you know. That to me was the universe telling me, "Oh, we're doing the right thing here. We're on the right track here." The universe demonstrates these things. Doesn't mean the converse does not necessarily mean that just because you get resistance sometimes doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing something. By the way, I don't want to be simplistic here, but that's a but the universe does tell us what to do if we're paying attention, in my view. Once again, don't take our word for it.
Yeah, there's one point I wanted to come back to something that came up in connection to what you were saying. And when we talk about this notion of verifying, you know, objective prayer is a practice, it's a way of aligning, and our job is to verify. But it is important to have faith, in the sense that faith is the willingness to verify. You know, faith is the willingness to test. If one doesn't have faith and one is just completely cynical, one will never, you'll say, "Why bother? There's no use. You know, I won't even make an effort." But for us, faith is that kind of positive openness, that it's not faith or belief in anything in particular, but it's the openness to be willing to explore this dimension and then verify for oneself what the results are. And that's how we gain knowledge. But we can't do it without some level of faith. We have to have some spark within us that intuits at some level that there's a point in trying. And we may have questions, we may have doubts, we may not really know the answer, but as long as we have the sense that there's a point in trying, then we can engage in objective prayer and allow that to be the basis by which we verify these deeper questions.
Okay. Any questions, comments at this point?
I can understand your opening this bookstore is a service to the community. Mm-hmm. And when I read the information about what you're going to talk about tonight, that was kind of what I thought you were going to talk about, how you are of service to others, because that's also a very Christian concept, you know. Mm-hmm. You got to go out and serve other people. But you're actually saying that it's the inner work, it's the mindfulness that then allows the outer service, but that the true service is a more being on the path and being very mindful and observant.
Mm-hmm. One moment.
Very different.
Yes, it is very different. It's a very good distinction. Thank you.
But it does facilitate the other, as you're saying in this case. It makes us more effective in serving mankind or whatever by first getting ourselves aligned.
It's exactly
that's
right.
That's why you said that was step one.
That's exactly right. You know, this that book I mentioned, Lost Christianity. He calls it. He says an intermediate step is needed between the desire to love others as yourself and the ability to love others as yourself. So in between those, a step is needed, and so that step is this practice of putting attention on your life moment by moment. In our view, that's how it works. That's exactly right. And your distinction, your point about being of service, I was just doing what it seemed like I was being told to do. You know, it's sort of like, oh, God put this idea. You know, Jim and Stuart and I had talked about, you know, having a bookstore. And then I was at a point where I had just finished some academic stuff and had a break, and we sat down and had this conversation that we had, a sort of similar conversation to what we had before, and said, well, let's go out and look for places. And we looked in Santa Rosa and we didn't see anything that looked right, and you know, and then I just happened to be walking up the street here, not realizing that this place would be open, and it presented itself. You know, the previous owner had a family illness, and they wanted to get out of the lease, it all just, you know, fell into place. And it's not because I had this desire to serve the community of Sebastopol, although that's really nice. And to be honest with you, I've gotten to know the town of Sebastopol in a way that I never got a chance to do before, when I was always driving off to Berkeley and other places. So it's been wonderful, but the service was in service of this process of self-examination and trusting that being true to self-examination of who I really am will connect me ever more profoundly to the rest of the universe, the more deeply I pursue that. And, you know, and that's our suggestion for how this works. So we don't start off with the idea of we're going to be of service, except on this, in a sense, very abstract way. You know, this abstract idea of service, except that we ground it immediately in what do I do now? Oh, I pay attention. I pay attention to how my body feels right now. I pay attention to how my heart space feels. I pay attention to what's going on in my head.
I'd like to add something to your point, which is that you know, the service of having a bookstore like this and is not about the books that we're selling. You know, some of the books I like, some of the books I wouldn't read myself and wouldn't recommend, but we sell them. You know, that's all fine. Where the service along the lines that Rob is describing comes here is in the quality of attention we put on the people in the store, for instance, and the quality of attention that we try to maintain in the space. And that's very different. It doesn't have to be a spiritual bookstore, but that happens to be what this is. But it's the practice, the practical work for us is being willing to put attention on the universe, both on ourselves and on others when they come in, and maintain that, to provide that that kind of energy. And it doesn't mean being attentive necessarily to someone so much as being willing to see someone, to allow someone in, you know, to be touched by the people who come in, and to be willing to be present for the people who come in. And whether they recognize it or not, that then allows for a resonance of a different kind of energy than ordinary interactions typically provide. And that's how, in this objective prayer sense, that service unfolds when one is doing one's work. The details of the store, you know, it's more a reflection of our personal tastes than it is of a any, you know, sort of objective sense that, you know, spiritual books are better than other books. But it is the space and the work we do in the space that's the unfolding of the service.
Yeah, our teacher used to say, the founder of Taiyo Meditation, she used to say, it's not what you do, it's how you do it. And by which he meant, the thing, the outer activity, whatever, is not the point. It's how you pay attention to that, the quality of attention you put on it from moment to moment, as you do anything and everything. So that's always the key. And that's what turns an ordinary moment into a sacred moment, or a series of sacred, continuous series of sacred moments, you know, to the extent that we can do that. You know, if I have my attention on my body, even as I'm sitting here speaking to you, I'm here present in a different way than I would be if I were not aware of my body, if I were not present in this thing here. You know, before I began my spiritual practice, it's very easy to get sort of lost in this headspace. But if you're sitting present in a body, no matter what you're doing, that changes the experience of it
dramatically. And that's why in our tradition, you know, we focus so heavily on the body, the heart, and the mind being attention being put on all three of those, ultimately simultaneously. We practice individuals at times, but the ultimate idea is to have this whole envelope and everything that it touches be suffused with attention. And that's the service. That's the prayer. The prayer that is then beaming out, you know, it's beaming radiation of prayer if you're putting attention on your life in that way. It's very cool because it has effects that are mostly unseen and unacknowledged around you by definition almost. But that's okay. One of the things about a human lifetime that makes it so amazing is that we have this ability with this, what Gurdjieff called third brain, that is the intellectual center, our highly developed intellectual center, is that we can see things and appreciate things in a way that other beings in this realm of existence can't do. But we're very new at it. We've only had language for, depending on which anthropologist you talk to, for maybe 50,000, 100,000, even if it's 2 million years, it's not that long. We haven't learned how to be present in a body like a cat with the addition of this new organism, this brain, this mind. So it's a challenge for us to do this, but it's a unique challenge for human beings and a very cool one. The people who do it right are just, you know, they just blow you away. At least they blow me away. It's very impressive. So thank you. That's a good question. Other questions or comments?
We were talking about the Christian altruism, and that was a step between. Mm-hmm. What is that intermediate step?
The intermediate step is being able to, is creating the conditions in yourself such that you can begin the practice of loving another as you love yourself. Actually, you know, that whole the whole both sides of the Christian equation, loving yourself, that's a hard one too for us. We have to do both, love yourself and love another. But to be able to even start that, you have to do that intermediate step. And what we're saying is that intermediate step is putting attention on what you're actually doing now. Not judging it, not evaluating it, not criticizing it, what's the Catholic phrase? What's that?
Analyzing.
Not analyzing it, but not looking at it with the intention to reform it. At least not at first. You just have to look at it. You have to be willing to see your own life as if you were looking at a movie up on the screen, or if you were looking at data. If you're a scientist and you're looking at data, your life is data. And looking at it rigorously and unflinchingly is not easy, but that is that first step. And then it becomes possible to cultivate the practice of love, of opening the heart.
That step comes after a fairly extended process of looking at oneself in this way.
Yeah.
And in the, you know, methodically, we have practices that are sort of like finger exercises of meditating or putting attention on our bodies, our feelings and the thoughts that arise in our minds. But I say finger exercises because the formal practices that we do on a regular basis are intended to be done all the time. And so whatever's happening, wherever we find ourselves, doing dishes at work, in an argument with a loved one, or any of those times are times where it's possible to observe what the sensations in the body are, what the feelings that are arising in one's emotional center, and what thoughts are driving these other activities. And we watch these things. We see these things without identifying. And that's a key point to emphasize, that we do not identify. We do not judge. We do not try to change what we see. And that non-identification is probably the hardest step of all, because we're so conditioned to want to be perfect, we're so conditioned to want to judge ourselves, and we're so conditioned to want to change ourselves, that actually being willing to be present to ourselves as we are, seeing that but not judging that, is actually a profound shift in our ordinary operation of consciousness. And that shift comes about as we cultivate what we call in this tradition presence. The putting of attention on our operating centers, the seeing ourselves objectively without identifying, begins to cultivate a sense of presence, or a sense of spaciousness, a sense of space, so that we can behold ourselves in a space where we're bigger than any of the particular manifestations that we see. And so that's the beginning step of objective prayer. That's like the foundation in which we begin to activate or put attention on our operating centers, and we begin to cultivate a sense of presence. We cultivate another layer, if you will, to our being, another dimension. Sometimes it's referred to because it sort of feels like a different dimension. When we're identified in our lives and we're going from thought to thought to thought to feeling to reaction, that's sort of flatland. But then when you can step above and see all of that happening, it's literally like a new dimension, a fourth dimension of consciousness, if you will, being awakened. It's there, it's latent, but we can awaken it. And when we awaken it, we develop a spaciousness or a presence. And that's the first step. That's the beginning of the process of, you know, going from point A to point B that you were asking about. That's part of the intermediary step, to cultivate this kind of presence where we can be with ourselves. And that step, the being willing to put attention on ourselves as we are, is really the secret of loving ourselves. We're being able to behold ourselves without flinching, to accept ourselves unconditionally. That's a tall order, and certainly a precursor to even having the possibility of being able to love someone else as yourself. First, you have to love yourself, and most of us invariably start from a place of shame, self-hatred, self-negation, however subtle and however much we don't admit it to ourselves, that's in there.
So shall we introduce our prayer, and it's, we can talk about its steps.
Yeah, we got the foundation in there, so mm-hmm. So we have a.
You two have to share.
I mean, I thought you printed out.
I counted it down. I paid attention. You two have to share. Thank you. Well, I mean, first basically, I'll just say, you know, that this is basically a blueprint for how to go about this process, and we can talk about how that works. But let's actually read it all together first, and then we can do that.
All together?
All together.
The prayer of presence. Attending the body, I move through all and everything. Attending the heart, I feel all and everything. Attending the mind, I cognize all and everything. Cultivating presence, I activate my being in acknowledgement of all and everything. Observing the empty mind, I accept all and everything. Observing the quickened body, I relax within all and everything. Observing the open heart, I surrender to all and everything. Observing the awakening of presence, I serve all and everything. In form and formlessness, presence and views, all and everything.
So we start off with these first three steps. With the body, attending the body, putting attention on the body, putting attention on the heart, putting attention on the mind. And that's the process that we were just discussing. This process of putting attention on your life in a coherent and continuing fashion through this the practice that we use. But as I said, there's other practices as well you can do. Having done that, and those three steps can take most of us years to do, we then begin the process of cultivating presence, by which the three centers, heart, mind, and body, are harmonized, or they've been harmonized in the previous three steps, and it's like a switch that we activate. And that is an acknowledgement of all and everything, partly because we connect to all and everything, partly because we are a holographic representation of all and everything. Then, from that point, we can begin really observing the empty mind, really observing the enlivened body, really observing the open heart, and proceed to experience the consequences of those.
Yeah. In that process of observing the empty mind, we come to realize acceptance for all that's happening. And as we awaken the body, we learn to be able to relax and to let go of so many of the tensions that really define how we bind ourselves. And in opening the heart, we surrender to all and everything. We're not defending, we're being receptive.
So then, having cultivated presence, presence awakens. And that's the point where the purest form of service begins to manifest. And then that has its consequences.
Yes, and the final consequence is in a sense, the returning to the totality. But it's an experiential thing. It's not something that we can, you know, just sort of lamely say with a phrase or something like, all is consciousness, or I am my Father in one, or, you know, all the different things. You know, these are all phrases that attempt to express that, but they're meaningless without the appropriate invocation that's described here.
These words are meaningless without the practice that gives them meaning. So it's the activity, the inner activity, that creates meaning to those words. It's not the other way around. And that's, you know, sometimes you know, the child that I was thought that saying the words, saying the phrase, would invoke the presence of God, or invoke whatever I was trying to do. But in fact,
It's the interactivity that does the that creates the invocation, that creates the space in ourselves for grace to fill us, so that we can accomplish these things. The words are just guidelines. They're reminders. They're post-its. They're mental post-its. And they are not necessarily any more useful than a mental post-it. In fact, they can become, if you cement the post-it in place, then it can become an obstacle. So you need to have a sense of its impermanence, of these directions as well, and any directions, any suggestions. But when these words are spoken, or any words are spoken, with the presence that this prayer refers to, then everything is sacralized. Everything is touched. Everything within the vibrational compass of that manifestation is touched. And you can accomplish things that miracles that you can't possibly have anticipated. That's where miracles come from, is being able to invoke spaces, invoke access to grace that is not possible in our ordinary states of mind, in our ordinary contracted heart spaces and intellectual spaces, and for that matter, body spaces. So this prayer is a prayer that we can use our bodies to accomplish. Our bodies in gratitude for all that is. All that is. You can enliven this whole thing. This whole sack of water can be a sacred sack of water and protoplasm, if you invoke it right. Sacred protoplasm. Holy, holy protoplasm. You know, the upbringing I had in the Catholic Church was really interesting. I mean, they had these wonderful invocational tools, and they had no clue what to do with them. I'm afraid the people that I had contact with, the folks who unfortunately didn't have the training that we're talking about,
because they were missing the middle step.
That's right. They were missing that middle step that got lost, and it's essential to have that. With that, tools of invocation are immensely powerful. You can create a bookstore. You can, you know,
make a fine meal.
Make a fine meal.
You can do anything that you ordinarily do with a greater depth, just a greater richness that is conveyed to those around us, and they feel it. They may not, particularly if they're not training in this sort of thing, they may not recognize what that difference is, but it'll be, there's a difference, a certain something that people begin to notice. That's why the saints that we see, all, you know, they all have this sort of glow about them. Even if you can't see their halos, you know, there's a sense of presence or a sense of depth, because they may be doing something very ordinary, like being a beggar, but there's this infinite depth
or
there.
Or a bookstore proprietor.
Yeah, a bookstore proprietor. So, other questions?
Well, thank you very much for coming. I hope that this has been useful, and we invite you back for our talk on the compassion.
Yeah, I will. I will also put a, I'll put a feature plug in. That, you know, one of the things that is a group that are we'll be working on with our meditation students is operationalizing the prayer of presence in the in some basic activities. For instance, in the making of candles.
Yes, we're going to be making prayer right. candles. To sell in the store here.
So each step of the process of making a like a dipped beeswax candle will be an articulation of this prayer, so that the candles that we'll sell will actually be charged in some way with a different kind of intention. And we do this partly because, you know, that's the way ancient objects of worship were created. They have this here. Spiritual teacher, a leader of a community we know named Lee Lazowick, who's very much into sacred bronze. And this is a Ganesha that's like from the 17th or 18th century that is one of the things that they pass around. But the reason they're interested in and resell these to their students and make these available is that this kind of object was created in a very intentional kind of process. It was created for devotional work. It was created to be a reminder of a certain something else, and this, you know, that bringing that kind of prayerful attention and that sense of being of service without an aim, if you will, was what went into making these kinds of religious objects. But we can do the same thing with making candles, and our claim for you all to test will be that burning them will be a different experience than burning a ordinary votive.
If you put your attention on it.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.